My name is John Kelly. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Thank you.
And my sobriety date is September the 4th, 99. And for that, I am very, very grateful. I'm just going to kind of rant for like 5 minutes, get the blood going. And I want to thank you for having us here. And you know, keep Joe in your prayers. But we feel very honored to be here. And even though we're in Kansas and you beat UT, I mean, it's okay. That aside, you know. We love doing this. We do a little deal in Dallas. We're from the Primary Purpose Group in Dallas, Texas, and I believe we're coming up on, what, 19 years? 19 years. And just to give you a little rundown of how we get where we're at, I mean, both of us are first-class knucklehead alcoholics. I mean, we are passed each other in and out of AA through the decade of the 90s. I mean, I would be getting in, he'd be going out, and it was just back and forth. Everybody was done with us. I mean, families, judges, you name it. And, you know, it's pretty amazing that we're here today. And, you know, I'm just kind of in awe about this whole thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and we're going to go through the big book, and that's what we do. We have a little meeting we do in Dallas every Sunday. We've been doing it for over 6 years, and we start from the title page, and we go through it line by line. It takes us about 15 weeks to do the first seven chapters, and that's kind of what we're going to do here today. Rather than going into all the history and all that stuff, we'll just kind of interject that as we go along, and he's going to kick us off, and just see where this takes us.
All right. My name is Michael Kelly. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Thanks to this book right here and a sponsor who knew what was inside it and a loving God of my own understanding, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since June 13th of the year 2000, and that's an absolute miracle for a guy like me. I'm not a newcomer to AA. I picked up my first desire ship back in 1985. Spent a lot of years in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and took a beating. But it's quite interesting. We're just going to get right into this thing. And the one thing I found out when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous the last time in 2000 was an interesting finding. I don't know if you've ever opened up a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and looked at that very first page. But have you ever noticed it's blank? That's how much I knew about staying sober. That was it. Everything I had tried failed miserably. Every plan I came up with failed. And the neatest thing is thank God on a Tuesday on June 13th, I walked into a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. We flipped the next page and here we are. How about that? You know, finally I found a place that knew what the problem was and knew what the solution was and got me from the problem to the solution. And if you turn the next page to this book, you get to the title page, which is titled Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And it's an interesting line there. For those of you who've spent some time in Alcoholics Anonymous, they introduced a new word to us here, because from 1985 to about 1998, I was convinced by people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that you were always going to be recovering from alcoholism. You're never going to recover. It was stated like a fact. And if you think about that, you look at that statement that you hear inside the walls of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's like, could you imagine if you broke your leg and you went to a hospital, and a doctor looked at you and said, that's a nasty break. And I hate to break it to you, but you're always going to be recovering from this broken leg. You're never going to recover. How much hope does that give one? You know, and it's interesting because we get into this first page and they describe themselves as recovered from alcoholism. You know, and right away it takes a lot of the controversy right out of the equation. You know, they tell you right there it's just an incorrect statement to say you're always going to be recovering from alcoholism. And they actually offer you up some hope. You know, and you start going through this book and you go past the table of contents. And I don't know about you, but is there any big book readers in this room? Did you read a lot of books? You know, when I read a book, I always thumbed through the beginning of a book and I worked myself right up to page one. And I just assumed the information prior to that was something, oh, let's get back to at a later time. But there's some very important information in the beginning of this book, and starting out with the preface, they really tell you what you have in front of you. And if you look at that second full paragraph in the preface, it really lays out what you have in front of you. You know, it says, because this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such a large number of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of its revisions made for both the second and third editions, and if you have a fourth edition, it includes that. That's a mountain of information they just laid at our feet. You know, first of all, this book right here is not a novel. It's, you know, I assumed you read it once, you set it on a shelf, and you recommended, hey, John, you know, you ought to read this book. It's really a good read. And right away they're telling you that is not what you have in front of you. You've got a textbook. And the only way I can go back and understand what a textbook is, in my mind, is go back to when you were in school. Take yourself back to when you were in math class. You walked into a classroom, there was a teacher up front. She had a stack of mathematics books. She handed one out to everyone. And what you did is you started in the beginning of the book and you learned how to add. Then you moved into the next chapters and they taught you how to subtract. So you found out 1 plus 1 equals 2. Then the later chapters showed you how to prove it. 2 minus 1 equals 1. And each chapter presented you with a problem and a solution and a course of action how to get there. And you couldn't just start out in the middle of the book. Could you imagine if they started us out on long division? We would have been lost immediately. So each chapter built on the previous chapter. So what we have here is a textbook, and it's no different than the math book. What we're looking at is we've got a book that's presented us with a problem, alcoholism. It's presented us with a solution, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's presented us with a course of action on how to get from the problem to the solution. And that's what we have, a textbook. And then the most amazing thing is they tell us that since this book has been written, it has been left untouched. So let's find out when the book was written. So if you flip the page, you look at the foreword of the first edition, and this is what really qualifies this book. It's going to qualify this textbook, and it says the foreword of the first edition. This is the foreword as it appeared in the first printing of the first edition in 1939. So now that we know this book was published in 1939, here we are at the end of 2006, and this book has been left untouched. Up to this point, they have not found a way to add to it or take away from it to make it any better. It has been left untouched. That's an amazing thing. You know, that's a pretty powerful statement. So now we're going to find out who wrote this textbook that has stayed so strong. And it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Anybody notice that word again? It's quite interesting. It kind of eliminates the debate. We're 4 or 5 pages into this thing, and here we are. We've got 100 men and women who have written a book, and they're making a bold statement. It says, we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So what is that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body? The best way I've ever heard it put was, I can't get through the day without drinking, and that drink is killing me. Think about it. What a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that is. Alcoholism as we know it. So now we know who wrote this book. It wasn't one person. Some people will say, well, Bill Wilson wrote this book. Well, you know what? Go back to the original manuscript. It's not the same, is it? Some things were changed. The 100 got together and said, okay, we've got the core of what you came up with. Now we're going to get it to where we want it to print. So these 100 people got together, and now they're going to tell you why they wrote this book. Is to show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. Can you imagine? What does the word precisely mean? They wrote down exactly what they did to go from a helpless, hopeless alcoholic to a recovered alcoholic. And thank God they did. Because could you imagine if they would have relied on word of mouth? Well, let's go by word of mouth. What did we find out about the recovered and the recovering thing? Word of mouth already removed the word recovered from Alcoholics Anonymous, as we know it in the rooms today. So what they did is they knew they had something so important. And can you imagine? I mean, people have been trying to help alcoholics for years. Since man first crushed grapes, people were trying to fix us. You know, they were giving us hobbies, giving us all these sorts of things to somehow try to get us to solve this problem that we were dealing with. But these people said, you know what? We found something that worked so wonderfully that, you know what? We're going to write down exactly what we did. So if someone else comes up, all they have to do is do precisely what we did, and they're going to get what we got. Pretty amazing statement. Now it says, for them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. So let's look at that line. If I have a drinking problem, this statement says, all I need is this document right here. I don't need any further authentication, and that's where some controversy comes in. Have you ever walked in? I remember walking into Alcoholics Anonymous, and there they had books, and they said, okay, you want to buy a book, and they had a little 12 and 12 in front of us, and they had a big book. I don't know about you, but which one did you reach for? Give me the skinny one. You know? You know? I love the 12 and 12, but we've got to understand what the 12 and 12 is, and if anyone has spent any time in the 12 and 12 and studied it, there's some interesting information in the beginning of that book. You go back to page 17 and it says, the book Alcoholics Anonymous became the basic text of the fellowship and still is. It says, this present volume proposes to broaden and deepen the understanding of the 12 steps as written in the earlier work. The 12 and 12 is someone looking back at 15 years sober, reflecting back on what the steps meant to him at that point. You know, and he made a bold statement. He said, if you want to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, get the big book, the basic text. So no, I don't need any further authentication. Then it's going to tell us, we think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. Most amazing thing is this book was not only written for the alcoholic. You know, we're the people that say, you know, what are you complaining about? I'm only hurting myself. We think it's all about us. Well, guess what? We found out after we sobered up that we devastated lives all around us. I mean, we were walking around pulling pins out of hand grenades all day long. Everyone's life around us was touched by alcoholism. Well, not only is this book written for the alcoholic, but it's written for everyone who has been touched by an alcoholic. Help them better understand. And the thing is, the statement says to help someone better understand. Because a non-alcoholic is never going to fully understand an alcoholic. And I can give you an example. If anyone's given birth in this room, you can tell me all about it. You can explain to me in detail. You can show me videos. You could bring me in a birthing room. I'm never going to fully understand what it's like to give birth to a child, nor will I ever. You can help me better understand it, but I'm never going to fully understand it. And that's what we're going to do here, is we're going to help people who are not an alcoholic to better understand alcoholism. And there's chapters devoted strictly for them, to the wives, anyone who, the loved ones of Alcoholics Anonymous, the family afterward, the employer. So there's information for them. And then the last sentence, which I love dearly, it says, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. They had no idea what they were writing. They couldn't have. Not only does it have advantages for the people out on the roads now that I'm not drinking, my coworkers, my family members, yes, this way of life has its advantages for all, but let's look at it. Over 200 fellowships with very specific problems that had nothing to do with alcoholism came to Alcoholics Anonymous and said, you've done wonderfully with this problem of alcoholism with your program. May we borrow your program, and we'd like to apply your program of action to our problem to see if we get the same solution that you have. So now we have over 200 fellowships that have nothing to do with drinking. Emotions Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, you look at it, the list goes on and on, that have nothing to do with alcoholism. How true could that statement be? Our way of living does have its advantages for all. Now if you flip the page, you go one line down from the top, it says, the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Anybody notice something about that statement? Anybody ever spent any time in the traditions before? That's almost our third tradition, isn't it? Almost. There's a very interesting word that was removed. And I had to ask the question, and my sponsor looked at me and he said, the problem is you don't know anything about being honest. That's probably why they removed it. And the fact of the matter is, that's probably true. You know, but if you look at it, they really knew what they were talking about back when they wrote this book. In order for this program to work, when I walk through this door, I have to have an honest desire to never pick up another drink as long as I live. And we ask the newcomer, are you done? Are you through? And everybody wants to say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But think about that. Through forever is a very long time. And we honestly have to ask ourselves, do you really want to be done for good and for all? And that's the catch, this whole thing. I have to have that honest desire to never pick up another drink as long as I live. There's the key to the membership of all of this. Now we're going to get into the forward of the second edition, and again, I'm just going to skim through because we have such limited time. But I love the forward of the second edition because it is just amazing. It gives us the history of what happened from 1939 to 1955. The raffling off a second edition, and when that second edition was published, they wanted to go back and give a little history of how this thing came about and how they're doing and what happened in that period of time from the first edition to the second edition. And if you look at it as you flip through this, you turn to the next page, and you really get to see how this thing came about. And it's an amazing thing. Can you imagine? I love going back to the story of Bill on that broken down business trip in Akron, sitting in that hotel room. Very little money in his pocket, wondering how the heck he's ever even going to get home. And you start looking at this, and he's sitting in the hotel lobby, and he's here down the hallway. What's down the hall? A bar. And he can hear the people inside, the tinkling of the glasses, and his butt's falling off, and what a moment in time. Could you imagine? He's out on an island all by himself, and here he is. What does he do? He walks into the bar and he doesn't order a drink. He gets a roll of nickels. How about that? Walks over to the phone and he starts picking up that phone and starts making calls, going through that church directory, desperately trying to find another alcoholic to work with to save his butt. After the first or second failed call, could you imagine if he would have given up? But no, he stuck with it. Finally got a hold of the Cyberlings, who knew Dr. Bob. You look at the history of it, before you know it, Dr. Bob agreed to give him, what, 15 minutes. He walks up, Dr. Bob's shaking like a leaf on a tree. He's saying, I only have a little time for you. And he says, I understand you look like you need a drink. And he spoke his language right there. That's where this thing began. That 15 minutes turned into till 2006, and this thing is still going on strong. You know, and you look at the bottom of that page, and just that little bit of history, it says, this seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. What an amazing line right there. And it was strenuous work. Think about it. Bill stuck with it, making those phone calls, failed attempts, trying and trying. That whole 6 months as he was... Prior to that moment, he was busting his butt working with other alcoholics, and no one was staying sober. But thank God he was. You know, and it, can you imagine? Vital to permanent recovery. Isn't that what we're here for? That honest desire to never pick up another drink as long as we live. And you look at that word vital, what does it mean? You know, my heart is a vital organ. You take that away, and guess what? I'm no longer living. You take away working with another alcoholic, and I'm no longer going to stay sober. There's no reading between the lines there. You go on further and you look at the growth of AA, and it was very slow. What were they up to? By 1935, they had, what, three people? You know, they're moving right along. By 1937, I think the documented numbers were about 40. By 39, when the book was published, they were up to 100, and some history books will actually tell you that they exaggerated a little. Who would have thought? Alcoholics exaggerating. You know, but here nor there. Let's say they're up to 100 people by 1939. Growth was slow. But then you turn to the next page and you really see what happened to Alcoholics Anonymous to put us on the map. You know, the first thing that happened was that article in the Liberty magazine. Numbers started shooting up. By 1939, we're up to 800 people. But what really, really put us on the map was the article Jack Alexander wrote for the Saturday Evening Post. Could you imagine? Here we've got a group of 800 or so alcoholics, and there's rumors going around. People are wondering, what is this thing going on? What do we have, another cult on our hands? And you look back, Saturday Evening Post and Jack Alexander, that was basically our 2020 and Barbara Walters of the day. He was going in to bust this thing wide open and find the dirt about what are they doing to these alcoholics. Well, the task at hand was to write an article on Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was thinking he was going to dig up some dirt, and before you knew it, he became one of our best friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. He wrote such a glowing article, he put us on the map. By the time that thing was published in the Saturday Evening Post, you look, by the close of 1941, we had 8,000 members. I mean, that growth spurt was amazing. Could you imagine putting 8,000 alcoholics in a room and this thing hadn't really found its direction yet? And everyone had an idea of how this thing was going to go. We should be doing this. We should be doing that. And thank God Bill knew from the history of what went wrong. Through the Washingtonians, where the Oxford groups had failed, they learned. And Bill knew that, you know what, we really need the traditions to hold us together. Without it, we could be as quick to go up and quick to go down as the Washingtonians, which they grew up fast and they went away just as fast in helping alcoholics. So that's when they came out with the 12 traditions. And thank God they did, because that's why we're here today. Without the traditions, who knows where Alcoholics Anonymous would be. By 1950, at the International Conference, they adopted the 12 traditions, and that's what holds us together. The steps are to the alcoholic. The traditions are to the group. That's what binds us together and keeps us strong. But you turn to the next page, and now we're going to get into the interesting part, and I'm about finished up. But if you look five lines down from the top, they do something amazing here. What they did is they wanted to find out how well they were doing from 1939 to 1955. How was Alcoholics Anonymous helping alcoholics? How well were they doing? And they went and they queried all of the groups, and they said, all right, give us your numbers. How are we doing so far? And if you look, it says, of alcoholics who came to AA, and here's the hook, and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Now let's break this thing down. What do they mean? These people show up, get a desire chip, and just hang around? Well, if you go back to the history of early AA, that is not how it went down. You look at it, at the original AA group in Akron, they have one meeting a week. A new guy showed up there, he got a little hope, and he was brought upstairs, and he wasn't allowed back into that meeting unless he got a sponsor, started working the steps, and got busy. That's when he got to move back downstairs again. You know, and really tried meant do the work. Back in the day, it was, if you want to join us, let's get busy, let's get to work. If you don't, there's the door. Get busy. You know, it was plain and simple. It wasn't being harsh. It was, you know what? They knew what worked, and if you didn't want to do what we did, they didn't ask you to hang around. They were successful. Could you imagine? People walking in up to this point, half this room, all they had to do was get a sponsor, work the steps, get off their butt, and help another alcoholic. 50% got sober at once. Then the knuckleheads like John and I, who began the process, the job got more important, the girl got more important, all those other worldly things got more important, got distracted, went and got their butt handed to them one more time, came back and said, all right, what is this side of the room doing? Please show us. And then they were up to 75%. Now here's the scary part. Before I get into the scary part, you look back and there's actually groups in Cleveland and in Minneapolis that had documented over 90% success rate in that time frame. It's amazing. Amazing. Now let's look at modern day. Dallas Center Group does something really interesting. It's a skewed number, but it's pretty accurate. It's really easy to tell how well we're doing today. Chip sales. 5 years ago, they sold 1,000 desire chips. That would mean today, at the end of the year, how many five-year chips do you think they sold? You can argue with the numbers, but it's as accurate as you can get. In Dallas today, you have less than 5% chance of seeing 5 years documented. It's frightening. We're failing horribly. So what's changed? I don't know about you, but a 100-proof bottle of vodka, I don't think has really changed from a 100-proof bottle of vodka in 1939, has it? I also told you that the book hasn't changed since 1939. It hasn't. 1939, it's the same book as it is in 2006 when you buy a brand new fourth edition. Same book, same program, nothing's changed. So what's changed? Well, the only thing left is one thing, isn't it? The people inside these rooms have changed. We've allowed it to change. Instead of holding someone accountable and saying, either do the work or there's the door, we want to love them into sobriety. Keep coming back. It's okay. Relapse is part of recovery. We laugh, but guess what? People are dying left and right. Dying. And what's changed is we've got so far away from what works that that's what's changed. And it's frightening. It's scary. If you look at the next page, I'll get off my soapbox for a second. If you look at the next page, here it is. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. I'm not saying this is the only way to get sober. I'm not saying this is the only way to live sober. Salvation Army has been sobering up drunks long before Alcoholics Anonymous ever came about. Fact is true. Church is doing it too. But here's the thing. If everything you've tried has failed, the one thing that hasn't changed and works almost flawlessly, right back to look at how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. If you haven't tried this yet, why not give it a shot? If you go to the forward of the third edition, I'm going to shut it down with this. It says, each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing his experience, strength, and hope. And I'm going to pass it off to John.
All right. I am John Kelly. I'm an alcoholic. It's kind of weird being up here sitting down because we're usually standing up, and it's like, this is like the kinder, softer Michael Kelly talking. I'm going to get ramped up, okay? You know, a lot of people in Dallas, I don't know about y'all, I don't know if y'all do those statistics here or whatever, but a lot of people in Dallas do not like us reading that stuff. They don't like us 50% then. How do you know then? I've seen emails, that these little chain emails going around, people getting really hacked off that we bring that stuff up. But we got to look at Alcoholics Anonymous. We're the outsiders. Big Book Thumpers are the outsiders in AA today. And it should be just the opposite. Right? I mean, they call us Big Book Dumpers, Big Book Nazis. Our friends in Iceland, they call them the Taliban, you know. People in Europe are real sketchy about using the word Nazi, you know. they don't like using that. That page that he just read on the forward to the second edition, that needs to wake us up. We're not doing good as a fellowship getting people sober today. I mean, it's sad. I mean, at least back in the day, half the people got sober right away. They got sober, they got busy, they got a sponsor, and they went to the hospital, they went to these places, and they found drunks, and they stuck together, and they got sober. You know, my sponsor, the whole reason our group Primary Purpose got started, my sponsor is Joe McQueenie, the first Joe McHugh of Joe and Charlie, right? That's how we got our group started 19 years ago. And we do one thing, we get into this program, and then we go out amongst our people and do this stuff. And it's just amazing that we're all sitting here today. And I'm going to start off on the doctor's opinion, and I'll interject a little history as we go along. But this is pretty amazing stuff. I mean, this doctor's opinion, they're giving us a little bit of credibility. Can you imagine if they wouldn't have had the doctor's opinion, it's just these guys' theory on how they stayed sober, right? Their experience on how they stayed sober. Now we got a little, if you ever get your hands on a first edition, a real first edition, you'll notice one thing. When they get to the end of the doctor's opinion, it says unnamed doctor or anonymous doctor, right? And I think when the second edition came out, Silkworth was like, all right, y'all can use my name now. This is good stuff, you know. But even he was kind of leery about putting his stuff on the line. And this guy that we're going to talk about is Dr. William Duncan Silkworth, right? And there's a great book out there. Go find it. You can get it at Amazon.com. But it's called The Little Doctor Who Loved Drunks. And he loved us. He loved us. He had an affinity for us. And there's some cool things going on at this period of, in history, right? Because we've got this Oxford movement, right? And they're doing first century Christianity, doing the Book of James and Corinthians and all this stuff. And they've got this program of action that keeps them grounded. And it's like this spiritual movement. And a group of them started helping out alcoholics, and they had some success, right? They had this program of action. But Dr. Bob's doing Oxford Group, and he's not staying sober, right? And about, you know, a few hundred miles away in New York, you've got this doctor, Dr. Silkworth, who loves drunks. And he works in this place called Towns Hospital, right? It's right off Central Park. The picture's back there. He worked with over 50,000 of us during his tenure at Towns Hospital. And he couldn't understand why is it, and we're going to get into it all in this, in the meat of this, but he couldn't understand why is it that that guy or that gal that comes into Towns Hospital back in the day who's drinking too much, right? They're going through some marital problems, or the business is failing, or they've had some issues in the past or whatever. They're drinking too much, and this person comes into that hospital and they counsel them, right? They talk to them about alcohol abuse, and they give them that hydrotherapy. You know what? I don't know what. We're clean drunks, I guess. They shoot us down with, hose us down with water. I don't know. And they lecture them, and they nurse them back to health, and they feed them properly, and this person understands what they know about alcoholism, scared to death. They leave the hospital, never to return. They chill, you know, they moderate. They stop drinking altogether. They just don't drink to excess anymore. Their life gets back on track. And then guys like me and Michael go to the same hospital, right, get the same treatment, the same therapy, the same food, get the same lectures, and I leave that hospital in high hopes. And in a short amount of time, I'm drinking again, and when I return to that hospital, I'm in far worse shape than the first time the doctor saw me. And man's been trying to answer that riddle since booze was invented. And there was another doctor, his name escapes me, he kind of had this little theory going, and Silkworth expanded upon it, and he came up with the theory that we're talking about. All right, but let's read what it says here in the book. It says, the doctor's opinion. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Credibility, right? Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he'd been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. And he's referring to Bill, right? Bill is a hopeless, hopeless alcoholic. In the course of his third treatment, Bill was also a knucklehead, right? He tried it, right? He went to Towns Hospital that first time. If you remember his story, we'll get into that the next hour, right? Bill thought, I've got it, knowledge, right? Bill, you know, three treatments, right? Bill's a knucklehead, you know. He leaves Towns Hospital, fares forth in high hopes, and he ends up there again, right? In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. I don't know if y'all are keeping track. Must. There's a must. I spent the whole decade of the 80s and 90s, everybody telling me there ain't no must in the big book. Depending on where you start counting, there's like 67 of them, all right? This is the third one so far, right? So this has become the basic of if you think about it, I mean, there's no must in the big book. I mean, and I take that, right? You know, here I am in the 80s trying to get sober, and they tell me there's no must. Keep coming back. And I'm taking these guys at face value, right? This is what I got to do, right? And then I get drunk, and they tell me I don't want it enough. Got to read the book. It's a textbook. We're going to study it over and over and over. It says, this man is, and 100 others have appeared to recover. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. Tried every other method there was, going to church, doing good deeds for my mama, you know, reading Tony Robbins books, doing some Tai Chi, eating better. Maybe if I just had the right workout program, every method failed, right? These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance. Because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, Dr. William D. Silkworth. Can you imagine a doctor writing that about you? You can add Jimmy Jack's doctor, you may rely absolutely on anything. My doctor's not writing that today. All right? But Silkworth wrote that about these guys, you know? So it says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as the mind. And he goes on to say, just a little paragraph. I mean, you got to realize, these people have been trying to fix us, right? They've been preying on us, giving us hobbies, locking us up, you know, trying to fix us. And they think it's our willpower. They think we're just a bad moral character, right? If I loved her enough, I wouldn't drink so much. Or if I really cared about my life, I wouldn't drink so much. They got no idea. But what Silkworth's theory says is, you know, our bodies are sickened as well. It ain't my willpower. You know, we got amazingly strong wills. If you want to test that during this little conference, pick someone out in this room and try to get them to do something they don't want to do. Let me know how that works out for you. I got willpower, but not when it comes to drinking. But that's what we're going to talk about here. It says, it did not justify us to be told that we couldn't control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life. There's me. That we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. I got the trifecta, all right, all three of those, right? These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. It's pretty amazing. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains for many things which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out on our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who's very jittery or befogged. Right? So they know the dangers of going through the withdrawals, you know, and who's had DTs? I mean, real DTs in here, not the shakes. I mean, the DTs, the bugs crawling on the wall, the voices, yeah, the good stuff. This is the stuff where your heart explodes, right? This is why you can die during withdrawals, right? We need hospitalization in those cases. Or as my sponsor says, anything short of that, a little orange juice and honey will get you through it. You know, but we need some hospitalization in a lot of cases. More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he's approached, and he has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. I'm going to read the first couple parts on this next page. It says, the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years of experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject. Next paragraph. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. That's a whole lot in that paragraph, right? So we got this little Oxford group going on, right? Silkworth at the same time is coming up with his theory on alcoholism, which we're going to get into, right? But you've got another little faction out there where some of these researchers, they're talking about this moral psychology, this psychic change. You know, when we get into Roland's story a little bit later on, you know, he went to the great Dr. Jung. Dr. Jung knew what the solution was for alcoholism, a spiritual experience, right? And he had Roland in his care for a year. Can you imagine seeing a psychiatrist living near him and seeing him for a year, right? The problem was, is although he knew the solution, a spiritual experience, Dr. Jung had no idea how to bring it about. And that's what he's talking about here. Can you imagine a doctor? I mean, I know we've got good doctors today, but Dr. Silkworth, his ego was in such check that he realized that he didn't know how to bring it about. You know, look what they do today. I mean, my God, I go to a doctor. I mean, who's been to multiple treatment centers? Anybody in here? I can't be the only knucklehead in here. Y'all ain't telling the truth. But we go to those doctors and they diagnose me as bipolar or manic depressive or this or that ADD. What's the new one? Is it bipolar? Is that the new catch? That's a catch-all, right? Dr. Silkworth put his stuff aside to come up with this theory. Dr. Jung, his ego was in such check that he knew what the solution was. He just had no idea how to bring it about. And we're sitting here today because in 1934, all of these pieces came together for Bill Wilson. They all came together. It's pretty amazing stuff. But let's flip the page and let's just get right into the good stuff. Because I love this. So he's going to get into this allergy or this medical assessment, right? And he says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, right? So right off the bat, he's saying if you are a real alcoholic, you're a chronic alcoholic, you are physically different than 90% of the world's population. We're different. I got an allergy to alcohol. I'm sensitive. My body doesn't react to alcohol the same way it does in my mama. Who's allergic to penicillin? What happens?
I don't take penicillin. I break out in a rash. I don't take penicillin.
All right. You know, people start swelling up, they break out into hives, and left unchecked, they can die from that reaction, right? Now, isn't that amazing? I get a nasty little infection, and I go to this doctor, and the doctor shoots me up with penicillin, and I'm back to my feet, right? It fixes me. Jimmy goes to the same doctor with the same infection. He gets penicillin shot. He takes that shot of penicillin. He has this allergic reaction to it. And all sorts of bad stuff happens, right? He's physically allergic to penicillin. Well, Silkworth is saying that about alcoholics. We react differently to booze than the rest of the world's population. And I don't break out into hives or stuff when I drink. You know, that's not that I've broken into some stuff. You know, but I don't break out into anything, right? But here's how the allergy reacts on me. Says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never. Right? So he's saying that if I'm a real alcoholic, I take a drink, I trigger this reaction, right? This allergy, right? The only thing a drink ever did for me is convince me that the next one was going to be better. Right? And you can do that test. I mean, step over to the nearest bar room, have a couple of drinks. Have a couple of drinks, shut her down, go home, end of story, good night, Irene, right? Try that a couple days in a row. You'll know your truth. See, a knucklehead like me, I get a little period of sober time in me, and the buddies are all watching the football game at Thanksgiving or whatever, and they're having a beer or two, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, any guy who hadn't drank for 30 days deserves a beer on Thanksgiving, right? And I got every intention of the world of just having a beer or two, but I take that drink, I trigger this phenomenon of craving, I'm powerless, I'm off to the races. The next one, the next one, the next one, right? Powerless. I have lost control. I cannot control how much I drink. There's a little question you got to answer in your heart of hearts. Can you control how much you drink? That's what he's talking about here. It's not that this is a huge thing. And this was kind of freeing at once, you know, when I first kind of understood that. It's like, wow, now that makes a lot of sense, right? But just knowing this gets me zero in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't do much, right? It says, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Any form at all. You got to read the labels. You know? No more Sunday night runs to the grocery store to stock up on, because I've overshot the mark by a mile, and I'm shaking and jittery, you know, and I'm hitting the grocery store for Listerine or vanilla extract or NyQuil or, you know, that Listerine, that'll do a trick on you. At least when you vomit, your breath, you know, your vomit smells good, you know, but. I was a hopeless alcoholic. I have drank some nasty stuff, you know, and we'll get to that later. But look what it says here. And I was at a treatment center one time, and they told me these next couple lines I'm going to read. They told me that this is why my life is unmanageable, and I'm going to dispute that, but we'll read it. Because he says, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they can't break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them, they become astonishingly difficult to solve. And the treatment center said, that's why your life's unmanageable, and I wrote that down. Wrong answer. Thank you for playing. You drink as much booze as I did? That stuff happens. Problems pile up. They become astonishingly difficult to solve. Those are consequences. You drink 24/7 like I did? That stuff happens. That is not why my life's unmanageable. My life's unmanageable because left to my own devices, I am unable to manage the decision to stay away from the very first one. Can't do it. I've lost the power to choose. But we'll get into that too. But look at this next paragraph. Frothy emotional appeals seldom suffice. You remember those frothy appeals from your loved ones? You know, my girlfriend back in the day, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you, even though I love you. My brain comes up with, single life's not that bad. You know what I mean? My mama pleading with me, your Uncle Melvin bled out because of alcoholism, your dad's a drunk, please don't drink, you're destroying everything. Seldom suffice. That judge giving me a stern warning from the bench. That boss who threatened to fire me. Those friends who threatened to leave me and left me. Frothy emotional pill did not suffice. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. There's another must. Whose message had depth and weight for me September the 4th, 1999? The guy who had a message that had depth and weight was this little old man who's like 80-something years old, who I got absolutely nothing in common with except for the fact that he drank as much booze or more than I ever dreamed of. And I was dying and he was free. He had been where I was at, and he knew the way out. His message had depth and weight. Whose message had depth and weight for Dr. Bob? Bill Wilson. Right? They spoke the same language. It says, in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand for a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. You old-timers around here, you people that are out carrying the message and stuff, we see these tragedies day in, day out. You know? I mean, you should roll with that, come down to Dallas and roll with us to some of the places that we attend. We call them wind-up joints, you know. Somebody asked me, why do you call them wind-up joints? Well, you keep drinking, you'll wind up here, you know. Hell, we had this little halfway house we do a big book study at just recently. Word through the grapevine was this girl, this lady who's struggled mightily with alcoholism for years. I mean, got in a bad situation, blackout drunk, and ended up with the wrong people, and they just pretty much set her on fire. We thought she was dead. That's what we were told. And we were at the meeting last Sunday night, and there she was. Burned up, gauzed up, a belly full of Mad Dog. You know, it's tragic. You know, to see people who are just like us, for whatever reason, cannot or will not get this, and they ain't no longer with us. You know, the state hospitals are full of people that look just like us. And they went to the well that one too many times. And now they're locked up in the institution, drooling on themselves, wearing diapers. And they ain't coming back. They ain't coming back. We feel that after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. And here's some more great stuff. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. True statement, right? let's make it a really true statement, because I don't want to rewrite the big book, but let's do it this way. Alcoholic men and women drink essentially because we love the effect. I mean, think about it. Normal people, you know, we've got the picture in our head, you know, the businessman comes home from work, little wifey poo's waiting there, the supper's on the table, the kids are doing the homework, husband comes in, he's got the newspaper or whatever, he sits down on his big chair, and he has a nice little cocktail before drink, before dinner, and it relaxes him and all that stuff. That effect, right? I'm an alcoholic. I love the effect. Remember that day? Remember those days when we were out there drinking, doing our deal, and it just wasn't going right for us, you know? Things just were not lining up. The job wasn't working out. The relationship's kind of on the rocks. My puppy's sick. The car ain't running right. I got to catch the mass transit bus, and it drives me nuts. Things aren't going right. But how did I feel when I took a drink? Did it fix any of those problems? Nope. But it changed the way I thought and felt. I want the effect. I want that effect. Think back to that first time. You know, I grew up, you know, everybody pat me on the butt, telling me how great I'm going to be, right? And got the best clothes, the best shoes. My parents loved me, made great grades in school, played every sport, did great in all those things. On the outward appearances, I got everything going for me, except I had this little voice in my head going, psst, you're a loser. Self-conscious, my mama called it, you know? Until I was 15 years old, I held out as long as I could. 15 years old at tennis camp, and I had my first experience drinking, and I was hooked. I was off to the races. I had arrived. You know, suddenly, all the dots were connected. You know, I was hip, slick, and cool. The chicks I was with wanted me. It was good, man, you know. I loved that effect. But he says, the sensation is so elusive. Now they're saying that I can't even get to that sensation. It's elusive. I can't catch it. Is it the third drink, the tenth drink, whatever? I can't get to that sense. It's elusive. It's like catching air. I can't grasp it all. Because whenever I get to that magic, I go right on past it. Alcohol take you to some places you never dreamed you'd end up. End up with some people you never dreamed you'd be with. Hell, I'd go home with Bo Derek, wake up with Bo Diddley, you know? That's the truth about alcoholism, right? But what's the false? What does my brain come up with? This time it'll be different. This time it ain't going to hurt me. This time I'll drink like a gentleman. You know how insane that is? I got zero experience drinking like a gentleman. Never done it. Can't pull that one off. It says, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Now, here's the fun stuff. They are restless, irritable, discontent. So you take booze out of my life, and for a short amount of time, I start to feel okay. But after a while, I just wake up, and I am restless, irritable, discontent guy. You know, I'm walking down the street minding my own business, and you call my name, and I'm like, what? You know, and you see me at an AA meeting, you ask me how I'm doing, I'm just glad to be sober today, you know? Right. Restless, irritable. I don't know what's making me that way, but I'm restless, and I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. I ain't too happy about not drinking. Unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes out once by taking these few drinks. Drinks we see others taking with impunity. So now I've taken a drink. After I succumb to this desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful with the firm resolution not to do it again. And that is repeated over and over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, in the words of my sponsor, you are screwed. And he didn't use that word when he told me. I'll let you fill in the blank. That's my life story. I hang on for dear life till I can't hang on anymore, and I drink, and I end up in worse condition than when I started, and I repeated that process over and over and over, and I kept getting lower and lower. It's a progressive illness. It's like cancer. You find out you got cancer. Is that the end of the deal? No. But left untreated, that cancer consumes the host. It gets worse until you die. Alcoholism is the same way. It's progressive in nature. Left untreated, we die from it. I love this paragraph. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once the psychic change has occurred, right, and they're going to give me some hope. The very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary, follow the steps. So they tell you what's going to happen left untreated, and they tell you what's going to happen if you follow the steps. From a trembling, despairing wreck, we're like risen from the ashes. We got a program of action to get us there, right? We're kind of up on our hour. I like the last page of the doctor's opinion. They're talking about, I believe it's Hank Parker. But he says, you know, this guy was a hopeless guy. And he says, however, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He's not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then. He is a fine specimen of manhood, as one would wish to meet. I earnestly advise that every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth. Some pretty amazing stuff in there. And we'll take a little break, and then we'll reconvene. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.